to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded July 1st, 2026. Well, last week, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio promised a big, fast, effective, and whole-of-government American response to the twin dinner hour earthquakes that struck near Venezuela's capital Wednesday last. Delcy Rodriguez's interim government welcomed foreign help in rescue efforts for the disaster, responsible for the deaths so far of an estimated 1,700 people, a toll expected to grow much higher in the coming days as more than 40,000 Venezuelans are reported missing through unofficial databases. Disaster teams from Mexico, the Dominican Republic, and El Salvador were joined by brigades from Colombia, Brazil, the U.S., and other countries. But Rubio's whole-of-government remark opens the prospect of an expanded and worrying American militarization of Venezuela's calamity. Ricardo Vosch is a journalist, political analyst, and contributor with the Communication Collectives, Tatui TV, and Utopics. His articles appear regularly at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. His latest there is Venezuela Earthquake Death Toll Rises, U.S. Southcom Deploys Military Assets. Ricardo Vosch in the first half. And just how ready is Canada for disaster? Last week, the Carney government announced the launch of an expanded atomic energy project, seeing 60-zero CANDU nuclear plants upgraded, while new, never-seen-in-Canada small modular reactors are built at Darlington's decades-old facility in Bowmanville, Ontario, with other sites from coast to coast to coast promised to follow. SMR proponents are quick to reassure the new CANDUs cannot become the Three Mile Islands, Chernobyl, or Fukushima's of the future, but still there are those who counsel caution. Professor M.V. Ramana is the Simons Chair in Disarmament, Global and Human Security at the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs at the University of British Columbia. He was too director pro tem for the school this past academic year. Professor M.V. Ramana and a January 2021 interview we did on the then new plans of Justin Trudeau's Liberals to take Canada's nuclear smaller with SMRs in the second half. But first, Ricardo Vosch and the twin tragedies to befall Venezuela. Welcome back to the program, Ricardo.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course. Now, Ricardo, as you may suspect, what coverage Canadians are getting on the disaster there is perverse, slanted, and disseminated with a wary eye to U.S. interests. What, Ricardo, can you tell us first about the situation there right now?
I mean, the first thing is that there's no sugarcoating it. This has been devastating. And I mean, I still think we haven't fully come to grips with the scale of the disaster. I mean, that's something that's going to happen in the coming days and weeks. Now we're getting to a point where the probability of finding survivors under the rubble is getting very close to zero. And so then comes the next stage, you know, on the one hand, the aid, the reconstruction, and on the other, also dealing with the families that lost their homes. So on the one hand, it's disgusting, if not surprising, that the media has seized the opportunity to further demonize Venezuela. And on the other, I mean, there's also, we have to be aware that this was really a terrible event. I mean, something that the country, certainly, I mean, no country needs this, but Venezuela was particularly vulnerable because when we talk about the devastation caused by the earthquake, this comes after 10 years of devastation caused by economic sanctions. It comes amidst this, semi-colonial tutelage regime from the United States. So it is a country, and in particular, a state that was especially vulnerable and unprepared to deal with something of this magnitude.
Well, Katie Simpson from the CBC's flagship show, that's the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the National, she was on a few days ago, and she was full on blaming what she said was the quote, the years of corruption of the Maduro regime, blaming the lack of preparation. I think, though, the lack of preparation for this type of earthquake can be forgiven, regardless of this, her snippy claim about Maduro's corruption. Earthquakes of this magnitude are not common in Venezuela. In fact, I don't think there has been one in at least living memory like this.
No, I mean, there was one in 1967, but it was nothing compared. And this one was actually a double earthquake. So you had 7.2 and 7.5 magnitude tremors, and they hit some 40 seconds apart. So yeah, on the one hand, it's hard to see how anyone could have been prepared for this. But as for the other comment, the thing is that you have to put it in context. You have to put it in perspective. I mean, of course, there was corruption in Venezuela, just like there was corruption anywhere else. But when you're talking about lack of preparation, I don't know, a lack of heavy machinery or operational heavy machinery, the Venezuelan government was explicitly banned from importing these kinds of equipment or even servicing, getting spare parts and so on. So it's a bit disingenuous to mention that without mentioning the other. And also, I mean, this might be unprompted, but there has been a specific line of attack against the housing mission. So you know that there's been a housing mission in Venezuela for some 15 years, delivered homes to millions of Venezuelan families at next to no cost. And there has been a consistent line of saying that, oh, the Chavez's social housing dream has collapsed and so on, suggesting that somehow the housing mission buildings were more affected than the others. And the evidence shows quite the contrary. I mean, there's no evidence that they were more affected. In Caracas, for example, there were several buildings that collapsed, but none of them are from the housing mission. In La Guaira, the most affected state close to the Caribbean Sea, again, they are a very small percentage. Some of them actually held surprisingly well in areas that were very heavily affected. Then you go to the other side. I mean, there has been widespread construction in La Guaira as a tourist hotspot. And now we see, or we suspect at least, that perhaps regulations were not fully complied with. I mean, this is an area that's known to be vulnerable to earthquakes, and clearly some buildings were not adequate to that respect. And so you can blame the government and the local authorities for turning a blind eye or not enforcing these regulations. But at the same time, you have to put it into context. This is a government that was starved for revenue, and tourism was a minor lifeline, but a lifeline nonetheless, to try and get the necessary income to keep the country going.
Well, to say disingenuous is fair to the CBC, more fair than they deserve. La Guaira was pretty much the foci of these two earthquakes. You're in Caracas. What's the situation like in Caracas? How bad is the damage there?
So here in Caracas, I mean, that was the first center of attention for two reasons. I mean, on the one hand, it's the capital, and on the other, La Guaira was left heavily incommunicado, so without cell phone coverage and so on. So it took a while to start getting the reports from down there. Here in Caracas, there were two or two and a half areas that particularly suffered. One of them was Los Palos Grandes. This is a upper middle class area that is known to be, because it's in kind of the lowest point of the valley, it's known to be vulnerable to earthquakes. And again, I mean, we talk about the social housing, but this is an upper middle class area that has always been locally governed by the opposition. And again, it looks like some buildings were not up to code. Another one was San Bernardino, which is on another upper middle class area on the hillside, where some buildings were clearly vulnerable. And the third one was El Paraíso. Beyond that, of course, I mean, everyone is very, very shaken up, you know, pardon the pun. But there doesn't seem to be significant structural damage. You know, in some cases, maybe walls came down or have significant cracks. But now we're all experts in buildings. Yes. The beams and columns seem to be okay. And so those buildings need repair works before they're safe to be occupied again, but they're not in danger.
What about infrastructure like electricity, plumbing, water supply?
Yeah, so one of the immediate things that the government did was to turn off the direct cooking gas supply, you know, to avoid any kind of secondary fires. For example, in my building, a leak was detected, and so that has to be fixed before the supply is turned on again. Electricity was down. I mean, I was without power for about 6 hours. But by now, I mean, the whole of Caracas is connected again. I mean, it was already maybe in the 24 hours after the earthquake. And even La Guaira has most of its electrical supply reconnected. Water, I mean, there were some big pipes that had issues, but I mean, those are not so complicated to repair. So in a way, life is coming back to normal. The subway is working again, but it's just kind of the collective trauma that needs to be overcome.
Well, that's remarkable. In your article, and again, it is Earthquake Death Toll Rises, U.S. Southcom Deploys Military Assets by Ricardo Vosch. Ricardo, in the article, you mentioned, and this is from the 26th of June, a few days ago, you mentioned at that point there was still 40,000 unaccounted for in the rubble, or just not reporting, or who knows what. What changes have there been to that number?
No, that number has actually grown. I mean, there are different unofficial accounts. I mean, some have 40,000, others have north of 50,000. But I think there are two important caveats there. I mean, on the one hand, there were people who were declared missing, but they were just, the relatives were unable to reach them because there were no communications. And also, the people themselves who run those websites have said that they are going to work to remove duplicate entries, so you know, people who have been reported more than once. So right now, the official death toll, I mean, by 1 p.m. is usually the time when they give an update. I suspect that the next update will take it over 2,000, but there's still a big gap towards that missing people number. I mean, this will have to converge at some point. We'll have to understand what happens to the other missing people, because right now, most of the buildings that are being inspected by the Venezuelan and foreign rescue teams, they are declaring that they found no signs of life inside. And so if there's a way for those bodies to be identified, they will be added to the official death toll. I mean, otherwise they will just remain as missing. But those two numbers they'll have to be compatible.
Well, and it's just after 1 p.m. local time as we're speaking right now, July 1st. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ricardo Vosch. Ricardo's a journalist. He's a political analyst and contributor with the communications collectives Tatui TV and Utopics. His articles appear regularly at VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We're speaking today in and around his recent piece up there, Venezuela Earthquake Death Toll Rises, U.S. Southcom Deploys Military Assets. Ricardo, your neighbors have sent disaster relief teams. This is a weekend now. As you say, the chances of recovery are getting pretty low, if not zero at this point. The United States, as your article mentions, and as I said off the top, they decided they would as well assist with a whole of government, quote, whole of government American response. That's from Marco Rubio. You allude to it in your article that it involves U.S. Southcom, which is the Southern Command, the military. What evidence of the American military are you seeing on the streets of Caracas and in other parts of Venezuela, more so than, of course, their growing numbers after the kidnapping of the president?
Yeah, I mean, of course, a couple of things have evolved since a few days ago when I wrote that. I mean, one of the immediate things that I cannot escape is that I'm now hearing helicopters, U.S. helicopters, flying over Caracas, I don't know, 4 or 5 times a day. They are, I mean, officially conducting disaster assessment readings, but I mean, of course, this is also reconnaissance and intelligence gathering. They're not going to waste this opportunity. But the Southern Command, the commander Francis Donovan said yesterday that there are 900 U.S. military personnel on the ground in Caracas right now, which is very significant. I'm not sure if he's counting the search and rescue teams that have also arrived, or if that's just military. But either way, it's something to be concerned. And also, how the U.S. has taken advantage of this disaster to increase its foothold. So the latest developments is that the airport that serves Caracas is actually in La Guaira, in one of these areas that was affected. And one of the runways was damaged. And so the Southern Command was able to come in quickly and put it back in operation. But the flip side or the consequence is that now, at least partially, the U.S. forces are running ground and tower operations in the airport. Same thing happened with the port. There's one of the country's main ports is in La Guaira. It also suffered, I don't think too significant, but minor damage. It was actually bombed on January 3rd, less than 6 months ago. So now there's a warship docked at the port. Apparently, they're also going to do some repairs to try and expand the capacity to receive aid by sea. But again, they're going to be in charge of, or at least partially in charge of, the operation. So the Trump administration has clearly positioned itself as a kind of gatekeeper for the upcoming aid and reconstruction efforts, which we know is a very lucrative business.
Well, you mentioned in your article that Simon Bolivar International Airport at LaGuardia was, at the time of writing, closed. That's the 26th of June. Is it open to commercial traffic at this point?
Not yet, but I suspect that's going to be reopened in a few days. Right now, it's only this U.S. military transport aircraft that have landed, and I think from a few other countries. Others have been diverted to a nearby airport in Valencia, and then they have to reach La Guaira or other areas by highway.
Now, and you mentioned, too, in your article that, and I'll quote, the Washington issues a new general license related to relief efforts, but has thus far maintained its sanctions regime targeting the Venezuelan economy. In Canada, Canada too has a sanctions regime against Venezuela. I'm looking at Global Affairs Canada's website dated yesterday, and they say they're sending monies, $5 million, and then they'll match Red Cross money raised to a total of $4 million, assuming the Red Cross can raise $4 million. Then that means the Canadian government will pitch in $9 million Canadian into helping. They say they've already delivered emergency relief items like blankets and mosquito nets and so forth. How far do you think $9 million Canadian dollars will go in addressing the situation on the ground in Venezuela today?
I mean, not so far. I mean, they're still, I mean, the estimates are still very preliminary, but I think the damage is going to be estimated in between 8 to 10 billion. And so on the one hand, you have to compare what's being pledged to what's actually needed. And on the other, maybe not in the case of Canada, but in the case of the U.S. has pledged $300 million through, you know, aid agencies and UN agencies and so on. But, I mean, if you put that into perspective, when the U.S. imposed an oil blockade in 2019, U.S. officials themselves estimated that it would cost Venezuela $10 million per day. So... sorry, $30 million per day. So what the U.S. is offering is basically the first 10 days of the oil blockade in January 2019. A different comparison, Venezuela still has, I mean, even though the Trump administration has officially recognized the Delcy Rodriguez acting administration, it has not released the Venezuelan assets that are frozen. And so those are estimated, again, between 11 and 13 billion, so 30 times more than what is being pledged here. And last but not least, I think we've discussed this the last time I was on. The U.S. currently controls Venezuelan oil export revenues, and it's taking an undisclosed slice out of it. And there's also significant delays in returning it. So basically, I mean, we've seen these pledges of aid that are surely necessary, but they happen amid a big picture that retains even amongst amidst the most terrible circumstances, maintains all these economic constraints on the Venezuelan, on the Venezuelan people and the economy at large.
Yeah, and as we talked about the last time, the setup the Americans have put in place now sees the U.S. Treasury Department intercepting or acting as middleman in all transactions of Venezuelan oil worth untold billions, and untold because they're not telling anybody. And then they say they promise to remit fairly back to Venezuela the proper amount of money. And we'll trust them when we trust Donald Trump and the rest of his cronies. Also, Caracas has asked the UK government, they have sat on billions worth of Venezuelan gold that was put in English banks for safekeeping. I don't know how, I mean, when, I think before Chavez first came into power, and it's been seized upon by the English ever since. And what was the UK response to the request for the return of the billion or the equal value of what they hold?
No, so far there has been no response. There's silence and this, you know, support platitudes that we're hearing from all over the place. I mean, some are genuine and some are just run-of-the-mill statements. But even with the U.S. license that you were mentioning, so the U.S. Treasury issued I think it's a four-month license allowing, quote-unquote, earthquake relief related transactions. But even so, I mean, it's not clear how it's going to work, because Venezuela, the way it works for any country, that I don't know, your central bank has a corresponding account in another country, and then it receives the funds, it brings them back, changes into local currency and distributes it. But in this case, the Venezuelan central bank, the oil company, the subsidiaries, the other public banks, they all still have their corresponding accounts frozen abroad. So even if, I don't know, Canada wants to send those 9 million, it cannot do so. So it's going to be necessarily channeled through the private sector, through the let's call it the NGO industrial complex, which maybe, I mean, of course, they're going to do necessary work, but it's not the most efficient way to do it. And it's also deliberately undermining the sovereignty of the Venezuelan state.
Yeah, the Canadian government, for its part, its sanctions came under the Special Economic Measures Act. And it is, quote, because of grave breaches of international peace and security, gross and systemic human rights violations and acts of significant corruption. It sounds like they're speaking about the United States here. There might be a typo. they don't say anything else. It's a very opaque release. They don't, Foreign Affairs Canada doesn't say anything about, or Global Affairs as they call themselves now. They don't say anything about changes to that sanctions regime, whatever. And yes, you're right. They do say that they will be sending the 5 million that was promised earlier. It will go 2 million of that to the World Food Program, 2 million to the Pan American Health Organization, and 1 million to the International Rescue Committee. Presumably the same setup will happen in the future as well. But they do say that they are, the government of Canada is interested in the urgent and life-saving help to those who need it most. Platitudes, of course.
Yeah, I mean, the issue is that we know from previous cases, and the one that obviously comes to mind is the 2010 earthquake in Haiti,
yeah,
where there were billions in aid that were pledged, but they ultimately never reached the Haitian people, or at least not in any significant way. I mean, they were used to organize aid conferences, but not necessarily to deliver aid. And here, I mean, I'm not going to claim that the Venezuelan government is super efficient or immune to corruption. But now what you are doing is that you're further taking away its ability to deliver basic services, and especially if we talk about reconstruction. So the housing mission in 2011, when Chavez launched it, it also came after natural disasters. There were heavy rains and mudslides and so on. And so it became a large-scale program to provide first dignified homes for those who had lost them in those mudslides. But then, you know, going further than that, I mean, going to people that had been in precarious accommodations since the 1999 mudslides that were very significant and you know, tens of thousands died, and actually very... In stark contrast to now, Chavez actually rejected that the Marines would disembark in Venezuela at the time. But then, I mean, the point I want to make is that now the Venezuelan state is in no condition. It does not have the resources to launch a similar housing program, you know, to provide houses for those that lost their houses in the earthquake. So it's going to become even more vulnerable, even more dependent on these foreign actors. I mean, this just, I think, one day before the earthquake, there were reports that the Venezuelan foreign debt was even bigger than previously estimated at $240 billion. So it's just a combination of factors that leaves the country even more vulnerable and even more dependent than before.
How, Ricardo, is there a way for rank and file Canadians and citizens outside of Venezuela, maybe expats or maybe people sending remittances, is there a way for people to send aid to Venezuela going around the sanctions regime or governments or these agencies?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated because of the sanctions regime, it's hard to receive money from abroad. At Venezuela Analysis, we're going to prepare a page compiling, you know, information about the earthquake, you know, the response, date, and so on, and also a list of fundraisers that we can vouch for. I mean, it's not an exhaustive list; it's just the ones that we know personally, and we can be sure that the resources are going to reach grassroots organizations that are going to deliver them where most needed. So, I mean, for now, there are two major ones organized in the US by Code Pink and the People's Forum. So those are already up and running. And there are a few smaller ones that we hope to link either later today or tomorrow on our website that people can also donate directly. And maybe find a way to reach the Venezuelan people, and particularly popular organizations that are most well suited to address these issues directly.
And that website is venezuelanalysis.com.
We're going to have a banner, scroll down on the website, we're going to have a banner that says, earthquake, and if you click there, you'll have all the information.
So I'm looking at the website right now, but I'm looking at your page, and before the earthquake hit, you have quite a number of articles up over the past month dealing with other maybe prosaic issues in some eyes, before anyone believes how caring the United States government or Canada, for that matter, is in the welfare of the Venezuelan people. One of your articles is U.S. conducts extrajudicial execution in Venezuela. Thanks, Rodriguez, for, quote, support. This is from blowing up the boats that people may or may not have already forgotten about in the Caribbean and on the Pacific as well, extrajudicially killing people. The Americans suspect of things that their friends are doing. Maybe it's just the competition they're worried about. Who knows? But these extrajudicial executions have moved offshore, and bombings are going on in Venezuela proper. Do you want to talk about that briefly?
Yeah, so that's another dangerous sign of the encroaching and the escalated involvement of, or even control, that the U.S. is exerting over Venezuelan territory. So again, I mean, as you were mentioning, this is just like blowing up the boats without any evidence, without bothering to give any kind of explanations, except it's now much more serious because it's happening inside Venezuelan territory. And here, I mean, if you connect the dots, there's no real mystery. I mean, they want to clear this southeast region for mining interests. And so this was a way for them, allegedly, to take out a leader of one of the armed groups that operates there and perhaps send a message to the others, because now it's the time for these major US and Canadian corporations, it must be said, to come and plunder these vast underground resources, having already pushed the Venezuelan government to change the legislation and tune it much more to these corporate interests.
You also have articles about retirees with the telecom, the Venezuelan telecom company, trying to get their retirement bonuses back. Others about rice growers staging protests. But I don't want to make it all seem like it's terrible news. You also have an article, monthly inflation hits 18-month low, exchange rate gap persists. Is the currency the earthquake aside, is the currency stabilizing?
I mean, very slowly it is, but still there's kind of there's a missing infrastructure to tackle currency speculation. And because the government is just so dependent right now on the US sending back these revenues, we're still not seeing how they're going to have some kind of stable macroeconomic outlook. But, I mean, of course, now the earthquake upends everything, and we'll have to see what happens going forward.
Yeah. Well, finally, Ricardo, how far do you think Venezuela, under the Rodriguez government, has to go to get relief from some of these egregious sanctions that Canada and the United States and the others that are afraid of the United States still levy against the economy and the people of Venezuela?
I think the ultimate conclusion is that the sanctions regime is here to stay. I mean, maybe we'll see the release of individual sanctions against leaders and so on, but the architecture is going to stay and be complemented by these individual licenses, because that's the way for the US to control who gets involved in Venezuela, who can come in and enjoy these lucrative deals. So either, I mean, on the general level, Western corporations, on a more specific level, the ones, the Trump cronies, the ones that have privileged access, and on the other hand, keeping out the quote-unquote competition, you know, companies from Russia, China, and so on. So I think this is going to become the modus operandi here, the way to maintain control over the Venezuelan economy, and now even further, like, you know, key infrastructure like ports and airports that we were discussing.
Well, Ricardo, I hope you all the best in the recovery to you and all of Venezuela. Again, Ricardo Vosch, you can find his articles at venezuelanalysis.com, among other places. Do look that up. Thanks a lot, Ricardo, for coming on and speaking with us again today in this difficult time.
Thank you, Chris. It's always a pleasure.
And I want everyone else to stay tuned. I'm going to take a break, but I'll be back with a story closer to home and a little bit older, too, about Canada's renaissance, its nuclear renaissance. Thanks again, Ricardo.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere.
Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago. Helsinki, Cape Town, South Carolina.